2 years ago, the government took over mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Now we have a number for how much that move could ultimately cost taxpayers. It's in the neighborhood of $154 billion. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have worked for decades to get more Americans to become homeowners, for better or worse. Well, today, a former Freddie Mac employee would like to say he's sorry for doing such a good job fulfilling that mission. To introduce us, here are NPR's Adam Davidson and Hannah Jaffe-Walt from our Planet Money team.
Jacob Kossoff will be delivering our apology today. We met him in kind of a strange way. Adam?
Yeah, he was mad at me. A few weeks ago, I did a Planet Money story on This American Life. I interviewed a bunch of people who work on Wall Street, and I could not find anybody to say two things. Number one, thank you, America. Thank you for bailing out my industry and probably saving my job. And number two, I'm sorry. I'm sorry for whatever small role I played in this financial crisis. Nobody that I found would say either.
And that is when Kossoff got in touch.
I guess I was a little annoyed that you didn't mention some people were grateful and apologetic.
Some people like Kossoff. Kossoff, who used to work at Freddie Mac, and now he works at a bank. He wants to, number one, Adam, apologize. And number two, say thank you. He wants each and every one of you listening to know that he is grateful.
I am. Thank you for the government money for Freddie Mac, which I think kept me employed. Thank you for the general bailout, which I think helped all financial firms.
Okay, now to the apology. Kossoff used to work at Freddie Mac as an economist in the mission department, as in their job was to promote the mission of home ownership.
Oh, I'd think I was putting people in housing that wouldn't be in housing, that subprime mortgages were great and that they were helping people that were low income that normally couldn't afford to buy a house. And I was very supportive and I thought subprime was the best thing in the world.
It was not until the spring of 2008, just months before Freddie would be bailed out by the federal government, that Kossoff began to question his most fundamental beliefs.
It's the first time I thought maybe there could be some times ever in your life possibly that renting could maybe be better.
And then, one scary day, he got up the guts to say what he was thinking out loud in the office.
Yeah, no, it was a bit like announcing, like, oh, there is no God. Like, the idea that housing was like God. It was like, of course it goes up. Of course it's a great deal. Buying is always better. Listen to your mom. Listen to your minister. Listen to the government. Listen to, you know, politicians. Everyone says it's better.
So Kossoff is sorry he didn't realize earlier that home ownership sometimes is not such a great idea. When he thinks about it, there's something very specific he could have done.
All right, so I go to freddiemac.org or what is
Kossoff takes us to an online calculator. He didn't make it, but while at Freddie Mac, he managed it. And at the top, there's a question in bright orange letters. Am I better off renting?
You plug in some numbers. What's your rent? What do you think is going to happen with house prices?
Okay, I think house prices will fall -1%. It'll say appreciation rate. Try to type in -1% there.
-1.
And then click calculate.
Get your results. Okay. Please fix following errors. Appreciation rate must be a number between 0 and 100.
That right there, that is what Jacob Kossoff is sorry for.
So I should have fixed that. I think I should have worked harder to get that resolved. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. You are sorry that you didn't allow for the possibility that home prices go down.
Yes. I'm sorry that I didn't, you know, send an email or work a little harder to get that fixed so the calculator would allow for the possibility of reality.
Kossoff has no idea, but he imagines maybe some people could have used that calculator to come to a very bad decision, to buy an overpriced house with a subprime mortgage when they should have just rented.
Now, we ran all of this by a spokesperson for Freddie Mac, and he said three things. Number one, they're aware of this problem with the calculator, and they're working with their outside vendor to fix it. Number two, they don't believe that anybody should make a major decision, like whether or not to buy a house, based solely on an online calculator. And number three, Freddie Mac believes that renting is a very good option for lots and lots of Americans, and they put a lot of money into that effort. I will say that at least as of right now, the calculator is still on their website, still not allowing for the possibility of home prices to fall. I'm Adam Davidson.
And I'm Hannah Jaffe-Walt, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank, offering sleeping money alerts to notify customers when their money could be doing more. Learn more at allybank.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. New flare-ups this week in the foreclosure crisis. Bank stocks got beaten up after word spread of pressure on lenders to buy back billions of dollars of questionable loans. And coming up, we'll talk to Joe Nocera of the New York Times about the fallout over allegedly fraudulent paperwork in thousands of foreclosure cases. But first, NPR's Chris Arnold reports on the efforts of consumer groups who argue that banks have also been deficient when it comes to helping homeowners avoid foreclosure.
Ever since these foreclosure paperwork problems came to light, the banks have said that they haven't been taking houses from anybody who shouldn't really be foreclosed on. But regulators and housing advocates say that's not actually true.
They are foreclosing on people who could and should be able to stay in their homes.
Mike Calhoun is president of the nonprofit Center for Responsible Lending. He says the banks aren't just making big mistakes with foreclosure documents.
The same companies who are messing up this paperwork are the ones who administer the foreclosure prevention programs, and there's lots of evidence that they're messing that up as well.
It was just so frustrating. I'm talking on a daily basis.
In the state of Maine, Nancy and John Longvall say that they've been struggling for the past 2 years to work with their lender, City Mortgage. They say one day they'd be told that they qualify for help under a government program that would lower their mortgage payments. Then they'd be told that they don't qualify. They say they've faxed in documents, the bank has lost them.
They would tell us we needed this paperwork. This person would say, no, you don't need that. We have that.
What am I supposed to do? I can't get any answers.
Nancy says after a while, she started losing her temper and yelling at the call center workers.
People can only take so much. And a couple of times I've had them scream at me.
Really? I mean, the call center person would be screaming at you and you'd be screaming at them?
Yeah.
And I said, what are you doing? Just hang up. I said, you don't have to listen to that nonsense. I don't.
John Longvall is a former construction worker. The couple bought their house back in 2004. They're grandparents now, and they wanted a house with some land around it, with space for the whole family, and they could afford that. They put down 20% and paid the mortgage for 4 years. Then they both lost work during the recession. But they still did have some income, enough, their housing counselor says, that they absolutely should qualify for a loan modification to let them keep their home. So John Longvall says it's been really hard to be in limbo for these past 2 years.
This is our dream. This is our retirement, supposedly. And at this point right now, everything that we own, dreams and all, are gone if this does not work.
City Mortgage says they are working with thousands of homeowners to help them stay in their houses, and the Longvalls do appear to be on the verge of finally getting a loan modification. But because of problems like this, the state of Maine has started what's called a mandatory mediation program.
So here in Maine, we have a mediation process.
Housing counselor Jennifer Habruin-Gordon explains that the idea is to cut through all this back and forth with the call centers and lost documents. If the homeowner requests it, the mortgage company has to provide a representative to sit down with the homeowner, their counselor, and a third-party mediator. The mediator collects all the relevant documents before the meeting, and they can see then if the homeowner qualifies for an offer for a more affordable loan payment.
So you have a day and a time where you can meet with all of those parties, with somebody with decision-making ability. Can you make me an offer, and what is that offer, and get the terms of that offer that day? You may get a permanent modification offered that day.
And it turns out that these efforts have been working really well. The state of Connecticut has a similar effort that's been up and running a little longer and is proving to be an effective backstop for homeowners who are told that they don't qualify for loan modifications. Roberta Palmer heads up that effort for the Connecticut court system. She says most homeowners take advantage of this, and a majority of them, 63%, end up getting to stay in their houses.
When it's done well, it really makes a huge impact.
Mike Calhoun with the Center for Responsible Lending says that this is one of the top priorities for housing advocates right now. He's been in meetings with senior government officials this week to push them to adopt a similar mediation requirement nationwide. He thinks that could help hundreds of thousands of people avoid foreclosure. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
Joined now by our friend from the world of business, Joe Nocera, who's in New York. Joe, thanks so much for being with us.
And thanks for having me, Scott.
Joe, Bank of America says it reviewed all the foreclosure affidavits in question and the facts in them were accurate.
That's right. They reviewed 102,000 affidavits in 3 weeks.
Can they do that?
That's pretty good work. Pretty short work, don't you think, Scott?
Well, I'm impressed. And does it suggest something to you?
Well, it suggests to me that they would like to foreclose a little bit faster. They're basically claiming that the underlying facts are that the homeowners in these cases have not been making their payments and ought to be foreclosed on. They're probably right about that. The problem that they face is it the Bank of America that owns the properties and has the right to take them back? And that's what this affidavit scandal has been all about. It's not just, somebody signing a bunch of documents without looking at the underlying paperwork. It's how real is the paperwork? And what happened, Scott, is that during the era of the bubble, when all these loans were being sold to Wall Street and passed around to investors and going from one hand to another, it really kind of became confusing about who owned what. So the banks really need to start proving that they own these properties that they want to reclaim.
And does Bank America have the legal standing to simply say these affidavits are legitimate and then move on to foreclosure?
It depends on a lot of things. There are certain places where the judicial system has basically saying, we don't trust you guys anymore, and you have to prove you have the underlying documentation in every single case. There are other judges in other districts who are so overwhelmed by the sheer caseload here that all they want to do is look at the affidavit and send it through, which just adds to the general unfairness of the whole situation.
The general unfairness being?
The general unfairness being, people who might have a legitimate claim that the bank doesn't really have the right to take over the property will lose the property. And in other cases, it will get a good, strong look by a judge. I was just going to say, this is not an issue of a legal technicality, Scott. They said this is just a technicality. These people really should lose their homes. But there is this thing called due process. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like saying, well, if you've committed a crime and I saw you do it, we don't even need to have a trial because you're obviously guilty. And you can't really do that in this country.
Let me ask you about this other legal challenge. And these are large investors, including the Federal Reserve, who say they want to sue the Bank of America unless they pay them back for loans that were backed by mortgages that allegedly violated their underwriting standards.
Right. This is a mounting issue as investors begin to organize and begin to kind of fight back. It's very simple. When an investor buys a bond that have underlying mortgage loans, there's also an agreement that basically say that those loans conform to certain standards. And what these investors are now saying is these loans did not conform to standards. They were terribly underwritten. They were problem loans. And therefore, the bank should be forced to buy them back. And so what you're going to see, Scott, I think, is a rising movement by the investment community, the owners of the mortgages, saying to the banks, we want you to buy these loan backs, and it's going to be a brutal, long, drawn-out war in the courtrooms.
That can't be good for business.
It's not good for anybody. It's not good for the courtrooms, for that matter. Everything that clogs up the system like this, both in the foreclosure area and in this buyback area, makes it harder for the country to come out of the economic difficulty that we're in, makes it harder for home prices to stabilize, makes it harder for the real estate market to rebound, which we all desperately want and need to happen.
Jonas Hara writes the Talking Business column for the New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
Raising the retirement age in France is just one of the ways governments across Europe are trying to deal with growing deficits. In Britain this past week, Prime Minister David Cameron's Conservatives announced the largest government spending cut since World War II. And it seems that lately, everyone is talking about one word.
Austerity. It's big in Europe. It's getting big here.
This is from a video clip posted by Mark Blythe. He's a political economist at Brown University.
This common sense of austerity, of reducing public debt all at once through slashing services, involves a question of equity. Who pays and who doesn't? Those who made this mess won't, while those who already paid for it through the bailouts will pay again through austerity. This is why austerity is not common sense. It's a nonsense, and a dangerous one at that.
Over the past few weeks, we've been canvassing the views of different economists on this program, asking for their views on how to tackle our economic problems. And this week, Mark Blythe joins me from Brown University. Mark Blythe, welcome to the program.
Nice to be here.
Now, as you know, many European governments are cutting spending. The word is austerity, right? This has sort of become kind of like the hot economic term now. And this is what many people seem to want their governments to do, to stop spending, to cut deficits. Would it be a good idea here in the U.S.?
Well, actually, I doubt it for one reason, what we would call a fallacy of composition problem. What's true of the whole is not true of the parts or the sum of the parts. If every household decides not to spend, you have no spending. If every country tries to clean its balance sheet at once, then you end up basically reducing the economy overall. Now, the argument, for example, as in the United Kingdom, which is leading the trend in austerity politics, is that we're in debt and we have to worry about the credibility we have in financial markets. So preempting this, the British government decided to clear its balance sheet, basically, and that has reduced lots and lots of government spending. Now, if every other country is continuing to spend and continuing to grow, you can have growth-friendly consolidation, as it's called. If, on the other hand, everyone does this at once, it's just the same as every household not spending. You end up with a shrinkage of the overall economy for no net gain.
So why do you think so many governments are doing this if, as you argue, it's a bad idea?
Because it has a wonderful ring of virtue about it. Austerity, the pain after the party. We all went out and gave ourselves mortgages we couldn't afford. We're drowning in debt and consumption. So there is this ring of virtue to austerity, and it chides with common sense.
So what you're saying is that if government engages in austerity measures, the public who paid for the bailouts are going to pay for austerity as well.
Absolutely. And this is why, as a foreigner who lived in the United States for a very long period of time, I actually have a great deal of sympathy with the Tea Party. And it goes like this. They understand that their mortgage didn't get a bailout, whereas some big bank's mortgage derivatives portfolio got a bailout, and they think that's unfair. It also means that that debt is accumulated and they're going to have to pay for this at some point. Well, isn't it then really unfair to double tax these people by having an asymmetric distribution in terms of who pays for the debt? Because if you cut government services, it's exactly the people who consume Medicare, Medicaid, teacher salaries. It's these things which will be hurt.
But many folks in the Tea Party are calling for austerity measures.
I know, and that's, to me, one of the greatest puzzles at the moment. I find it very difficult to understand how that link is drawn. Now, the argument is we need to cut taxes. Well, okay, we need to cut taxes to stimulate the economy. That makes the deficit worse. Okay, so what we need to do is not raise taxes, the third rail of politics. Well, then how do you expect to consolidate the deficit? There are many contradictions in these arguments, and they're born of a sense of frustration out of what I think is the intuitive understanding people have that something deeply unfair is going on.
So, as you know, we've had many economists on the program over the past few weeks and months asking them, how can we tackle these twin problems of high unemployment, slow growth? Some have suggested stimulus. Some have suggested austerity. What do you say? What could the government do now?
The austerity people will argue that we need to consolidate balance sheets and clean things up and reduce the debt, and after that, the private sector will recover. That's a very, very large bet that's based upon the fact that if you get rid of public spending, private spending will take its place, a crowding out of private spending. If that was the case, interest rates should be much higher than they are. So what the government needs to do is to spend enough to maintain the rate of growth in gross domestic product so that things don't get any worse than they are now, allowing people who are in employment to pay back debt, to increase savings, to consolidate and clean up their balance sheets. Then private spending can continue.
That's Mark Blythe. He's a professor of international political economy at Brown University. He has an upcoming book. It's called Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea. It'll be released next year. And you can see his video breaking down austerity at our website, npr.org. Mark Blythe, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.